couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new film Separation, Without Remorse, Things Heard and Seen, The Mitchells versus the Machines, and The Secrets of the Whales. I'll also be talking about some news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring a look back at the Beverly Hills Cop franchise. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Before I talk about my Oscar recap, I want to talk about David Cronenberg. He's got a new film lined up, and it's called Crimes of the Future, which is going to be released by Neon. And it's his first foray back into science fiction since he did Existence more than 20 years ago. Now, I appreciate David Cronenberg's more dramatic, pragmatic, down-to-earth, and crime-driven movies, but my favorite Cronenberg stuff is the stuff he did in the 70s and the 80s, and even into the 90s with stuff like Existence. But I like his original core work, and this looks like it's dipping into that as well. I don't know if it has any connection to his movie Crimes of the Future, which was his second experimental film. It was a sort of shot without sound and then dubbed over movie from the 1970 that had, I think it was like 65 minutes long. You can find it on the internet, and it's been released on some of his later movies as like a special bonus piece. But I don't know if it has any connection to it, even though it has the same name. But according to the press write-up, this is what the film's about. It says the film takes a deep dive into the not-so-distant future when humankind is learning to adapt to its synthetic surroundings. This evolution moves humans beyond their natural state and into a metamorphosis, altering their biological makeup. While some embrace the limitless potential of transhumanism, others attempt to police it. Now, what's interesting is if you go back and you look at some of his earlier works, stuff like the middle work would be Videodrome. This immediately reminds me of Videodrome, where there was an evolution, a technology evolution that happened. And of course, that was based on 80s technology of videotape and video signals. And I've always thought that Videodrome is something you could remake in the modern world and make it kind of interesting. Whereas like they remade Rabbit, and Rabbit was, I didn't think the remake of Rabbit was very good. While it tried to deal with politics and gender roles of the day compared to what they did back when Rabbit first came out in the 70s. I don't think it was as successful of a remake as it could have been, but I think Videodrome could lend itself. And this almost feels like it's an offshoot of what Videodrome was trying to do with the, live long in the new flesh of this, whatever form humans have that transcends our normal physical, biological bodies. So I'm looking forward to this. I'm a big fan of Cronenberg. It's great to see him dive back into his work and dive back into science fiction and body horror in particular. Now, the piece of news that a lot of people have been talking about is just the Oscar recap. I know I had my 6 choices, and I bombed on the best actor ones. I guessed Lakeith Stanfield would win for Judas and the Black Messiah. It was Daniel Kaluuya who ended up winning, and good for him. I mean, I think they both came out of a great piece and both did great jobs, so I have no issue with that. I was accurate on everything else, including Nomadland winning Best Picture, Best Director, and Best Actress. But it was the upset of the Best Actor that I think just surprised everybody, that Anthony Hopkins took it. Nothing against Anthony Hopkins, and certainly nothing against his performance in The Father. It's just I think everybody, including the people who put the Oscars together, were expecting Chadwick Boseman to win. And I have a feeling that people ended up voting for Hopkins, thinking everyone else was going to vote for Boseman. But when it comes to the Oscars, this was a dreadful Oscar broadcast. Now, they had to make some changes because of the coronavirus, and I actually liked the venue. I liked the more settled down, relaxed setting. It reminded me a little bit of the Golden Globes, with kind of having tables and a more of a dinner look to the place than it does in a theater. I liked the venue. I liked the red carpet stuff. I liked the interviews outside. I liked them moving it into something different. But I think they needed to put the clips. I don't know why they didn't put Oscar clips in there. I mean, that's the one thing. How does the pandemic affect putting Oscar clips in? They're literally on videotape that you can just pop in there, or on digital. And then there's the best actor thing, which was weird, moving it after the best picture. I think they did that because they were expecting some bittersweet, whoa, isn't it sad that his widow has to come up and do this? And they wanted to end on that sort of uplifting note, but it ended up just whiffing it and ended up on a WTF moment. Now, this was the least watched Oscars in the history of keeping track of it, I think. Less than 10 million people watched. And look, the first thing I want to say, don't fall into the trap of no one ever saw these films or look at the low box office. This season, more than any other one, bucks that, because like half the best pictures were directly on streaming, stuff like The Trial of the Chicago 7, and even Nomadland, which had a run in theaters. It ended up on Hulu at the end of last year or the beginning of this year and got a really good run on Hulu. So a lot more people watch these movies than the box office would say, because streamers don't have to share that information. I think the biggest thing to take away from this is it's not that people don't like the Oscars. I think award shows in general are becoming obsolete. It used to be that the Oscars were the only award show and that was the only game in town. But there's so many other award shows that lead up to it that by the time you get to the Oscars, people are kind of shrugging, going, whatever. But also, people don't want us to have to sit down and watch 3 hours or more of a broadcast show. People have way too many options with the internet and phones and now streaming. There's no reason anyone wants to sit down and watch a 3-hour live broadcast. People want highlights or they want something quicker. So the first thing they could do if they wanted more attention is cut the length of the production. The second thing you got to realize is that fewer people have broadcast TV now. Sure, you can pull ABC out of the air, but you need a special antenna on a new TV to do that. And those antennas aren't great and they're expensive. So the only people that are doing that are people who don't want to pay for cable and don't have streaming or anything. You're talking about the, you know, senior citizen generation who just want to watch the local news, and they're maybe watching it on an old-fashioned tube TV. But the fact that this was on ABC, there's a lot of people who've cut cable who can't watch the ceremony and weren't able to watch the ceremony. So it's maddening that Hollywood hasn't figured that out yet. Simulcast it or something and then make it short. If they made the Oscars an hour long, gave Dave Chappelle the hosting job without script approval from the studio, and then broadcast it on all the major streamers, you'd have billions of people watching it. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That song means it's time to roll into the trailer park. I'm going to play a F9 trailer right now because I haven't played one of this in almost a year and a half, and this movie's still not out because of the pandemic, but this comes out in theaters on June 25th.
Been a long time, Dom. Little brother.
You always say never turn your back on family, but you turned your back on me. Now your little family is in my world.
Whatever's on you,
is you ready?
It's on us.
Are you ready?
He's got his own private army. We need help.
No way.
Is you ready? Oh, whole squad ready.
So how do y'all want to play this?
Fast.
A thing to note, even as exciting and as much of a spectacle as this movie looks, according to the internet, the running time is 3 hours and 8 minutes. Why in the world do we need a 3-hour-plus Fast and Furious movie? I'm sure that they're fun. But my God, this is not Return of the King, for crying out loud. The next one I want to hit really quickly is West Side Story, which is in theaters on December 10th.
There's a place for us. Somewhere, a place for us.
This teaser dropped during the Oscars. There's not much to it. We don't get as much singing and dancing in the trailers we do in The Heights, but at least it looks like it's updated it a little bit to not be as hokey and corny. That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about The Secret of the Whales and Without Remorse. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the reviews. I want to start with one that's actually a week old. It came out last week. It actually came out midweek last week because it was part of the Earth Day push that Disney Plus had. And that is The Secrets of the Whales. This four-part documentary series on Disney Plus follows five species of whales to learn more about them. I do know that that didn't have any human words in it, but people are talking throughout that trailer. Of course, those are whales. My apologies if any of that was profanity in whale language. I'll have to talk to Dory the fish because she speaks whale. I don't think any of it was bad words, though. I think that it was just whales talking to each other, singing their song of the people. Anyways, I know it was last week was Earth Day, Earth Week. It was the 22nd. And this goes to a history that Disney has. For years, like 10 years, starting back in, I think, 2009, more than 10 years ago, they started to release a nature documentary on Earth Day. And they started with Disney's Earth, and then they did oceans, and then they started to narrow it down. They did one about African cats, they did one about a chimpanzee, they did one about monkeys. And I love these things. I really authentically enjoy these Disney nature shows. Now, they had paired an earlier ones with BBC, and they basically re-edited BBC's Earth into and Oceans into the first two movies. But now they're working with National Geographic because Disney owns National Geographic, and they're sort of moving these and streamlining these into a nice chunk of options and programming options you have on Disney Plus. And Disney has had a long history of doing nature documentaries. You can go back into the 60s and the 70s, and they did a whole bunch of nature documentaries that aired. I think some may have aired in the theaters, but a lot of them aired on like The Wonderful World of Disney or something like that. And so I like them getting back to that. I like the fact that Disney Plus is trying to make the service more than just classic Disney Channel stuff, or more than just something that has a Star Wars channel and a Marvel channel, and they're opening it up, and they're really exploring what they can do. And I talked about Earth Moods, I think it was last week, which was about that sort of the screensaver type elements that they have on Disney Plus, and that's wonderful. I still watch those. You can just cycle through those. These nature documentaries of the whales are fantastic. They spotlight five different species. They spotlight orcas in one. They spotlight humpback whales in another, and sperm whales in another. And then they get, like, two of them get, because they kind of cross over a little bit, you've got belugas and narwhals getting a spotlight in I think it's actually the third episode. The one I find fascinating is the sperm whale one, because you don't see a whole lot about those whales. You see tons of stuff about orcas and humpbacks, and those are good episodes. And even the beluga and narwhal one are very interesting because they show the family dynamic of these animals, and they delve deeper into their language and their communication techniques and how even their culture is different depending on what part of the world they're found in. But it's the one on sperm whales I find most fascinating, because in general, sperm whales, I mean, although all whales have to come to the surface, sperm whales are mostly deep sea divers. They feed down near the bottom of the ocean. Well, they don't have the ability to follow them down there, but they're able to find the pods when they're on the surface, and they're able to kind of, in some ways, even reconstruct what they eat and the giant squid that they have down in the ocean. These are fascinating documentaries, and they are beautifully shot, high def on your TV. They're worth watching. I mean, obviously, they're not like Earth Moods. You got to watch them because they have a narration. Sigourney Weaver does it. But these are fantastic nature documentaries that are worth checking out if you have any sort of interest in whales or anything in the natural world. It's absolutely rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Without Remorse now. Based on the works of Tom Clancy, Michael B. Jordan plays a Navy SEAL whose wife is murdered, which sends him on an international mission of revenge.
You took everything from me.
These were foreign attacks on U.S. soil.
We have to respond.
I'm gonna make it right.
There's something inside of me that I can't turn off. A part of me that won't stop for anything. No remorse.
I have not read any of Tom Clancy's works at all. This is a character that Tom Clancy created in like 93, I think it was when the first book was published. But this is the second most popular character, or second to Jack Ryan. Now, the thing with Jack Ryan is he's had ups and downs, and sort of the quality of those films are all over the map. Of course, starting with Hunt for Red October in the late 80s, but, you know, they bounced around to have multiple people. Everyone, Harrison Ford's most recognizable. Well, now they've got John Krasinski on a TV series, and they bounce around through everyone from Chris Pine to Ben Affleck. And this character is very different because he's ultimately a Navy SEAL, and this is early in his career where, like, this strike team ends up killing his wife, and he goes after him. Now, it does kind of have a bit of a flavor of John Wick, where his family's attacked and he goes after the perpetrators. My biggest struggle with this movie is Michael B. Jordan. He plays very heavily into the angry young man role. And I think that's something we've seen so much of with him doing the Creed movies. And he brought that to Black Panther when he played the bad guy in Black Panther, but I think there was a little more depth to his character in Black Panther. This one is just, I am out for revenge. I'm going to kill the people who killed my wife, and nothing's going to get in my way. And I mean, I can appreciate that as a storyline. I just think that Michael B. Jordan's been there, done that. He's a better actor than that, and I want to see him do something a little more nuanced. And maybe they're holding that out for more movies, because they're clearly wanting to make a franchise out of this. This is also not as exciting as a Jack Ryan movie. I know they meant to put this into theaters, and it ended up pivoting towards Amazon Prime. This doesn't feel as cinematic as even the Jack Ryan series feels a little more cinematic, although the Jack Ryan series on Amazon feels more like something out of Britain, you know, something like MI5 or something like that. Now, I think one of the reasons Amazon jumped on this is they want the character of John Kelly, John Clark, that they could eventually do a series out of. In terms of size, this felt more like the size of Atomic Blonde without a naked Charlize Theron. As compared to a Bond movie, it wants to be a Bond movie, but it doesn't have as much control over the character. And that's where it feels very Atomic Blonde, where it's dealing a lot with the Eastern Bloc and it's dealing with more limited locations. And while there's some great action sequences, and in particular, the gunfire, them being pinned down, are pretty exhilarating. It in some ways, this does just feel like the first chapter. And I wish they would have thrown more into this to make it a little bit more meaty of a story, because it does, you know, it's right in the middle in terms of enjoyable. Now, if you've got Amazon Prime, you can sit down, you can watch it on a Friday night and enjoy it. It's just one of those that I just felt like it could have been better, even though it's okay for what it is. So I'm going to have to say that Without Remorse kind of rocks. I was just hoping for it a little bit more. But maybe we'll get that later on. Who knows?
It kind of rocks.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Separation and the Mitchells versus the Machines. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews and talk about Separation. During a bitter divorce, a mother is killed and her lingering spirit haunts their house and tries to influence their daughter.
How are you holding up, brother?
I can't believe she's gone. Things at home have been strange. What are you doing?
Baby is painting. Daddy, where do you think Mommy is now?
How's she holding up?
Jenny said she saw something in her room.
Where'd you see this?
I'm not supposed to tell.
I felt something up there.
It's bad.
One thing I've noticed with the pandemic is these smaller, more intimate horror movies have been finding a place in theaters. Part of the reason for this is, unless you're doing something like The Conjuring or A Quiet Place that are these very high-level, noticeable horror movies, a lot of times horror movies can kind of act as filler. And you'll see them being released throughout the year, and in January and August tend to be really heavy times to get horror movies, but you get them released throughout the year, and they're nice to have in there where you can put, you know, a handful of people in the theaters and you can make a couple $1 million off of them. Generally, horror movies don't cost that much. And what's happened is so many movies have left the lineup that you don't have it opening up against anything. So all you have left are some of these horror movies. And we saw this actually last year. Some of the movies that IFC Midnight released, which are usually very, very small films, got some good play because they were still able to be released during the pandemic. And I think you're going to see that throughout this year as well. And that's, I think, where separation is going to rise. We saw this with The Unholy a couple weeks ago. These movies don't get a huge audience, but they didn't cost much to make. And that makes a risk-to-return potential of very profitable horror movies. Separation, I think, it rises above a lot of run-of-the-mill horror movies that are released by studios because it actually has the stones to deliver an R rating. Now, it delivers the R rating without overt gore and graphicness. I mean, like Mortal Kombat went for an R rating last week, and you could definitely see where Mortal Kombat was going for the R rating because, you know, he had hearts being ripped out and heads being cut off and all that kind of stuff. This one is just, I think it just has some language. As I remember watching it going, I don't recall it being overtly graphic, but it does have some graphic moments. It has some very creepy moments. I wouldn't say scary necessarily, but that's because I am so used to seeing horror movies, not a whole lot scares me. But a lot of things are creepy, and it has some really fantastic imagery in here. The movie itself is mostly about this separation or this divorce, hence the name. And the mother and the father are fighting and have been wanting to separate. And the only thing keeping them talking to each other is the fact that they share a daughter. And of course, they're fighting over it. And then the mother's father, played by Brian Cox, who I love as an actor, he is also trying to fight for her custody after she dies. But it's all this nasty domestic stuff that is at the heart of the film. And we've seen this done before, where domestic angst gets manifested into a horror movie, where the ghosts are symbolic of the problems that the people are having in their own life. And there's a lot of symbolism there, and that's very common in horror movies. In fact, we'll be talking about another one down the line here in another segment or two. But I think Separation handles it decently. It's a bit heavy-handed in using that. And the other big problem I had with it is this is a trend in horror movies is to shoot everything dark with muted light. And it makes you wonder, do people actually buy light bulbs in horror movies? Because the house is so poorly lit. And I think that's a cop-out. And I know that they've done that a lot. It really takes a good hand at horror to make something scary when the lights are on. And that's one of the things James Wan has done with the Conjuring franchise. And one of the things he was trying to do, at least Insidious Part 2, he was trying to do scary stuff in very bright light. And that's a challenge, but it's not impossible. I mean, look at Midsommar from a couple years ago. That movie is kind of terrifying, and it literally takes place in the land of the midnight sun. So you have light all the time, and that adds to the offsetting balance of the movie. And I think it's a crutch to just shoot everything with muted light. So that's something they do in this movie. But overall, I mean, I think it balances the typical ghost story plot with enough of reality that people do face. And it doesn't get too heavy-handed in that. I mean, it's somewhat predictable. I've seen a lot of this done before, but I think it's an effective done. In particular, the ghost moments and the creepy scenes that I think were incredibly effective. Plus, the cast is pretty good. I love having Brian Cox in a movie like this. He tends to ground it pretty well. So I'm going to have to say that Separation kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the Mitchells versus the Machines. During a reluctant road trip, a misfit family becomes the only ones who can help save the world from the robot apocalypse.
Every family has its challenges.
We haven't had a good family picture in years because you two are always arguing.
For my family, our greatest challenge... probably the robot apocalypse.
Attention all robots. Captain! every single person on the planet.
We're the last people left. It's up to us to save the world.
This is another movie that we've been seeing a lot of these over the last year or so that was meant to go to theaters, but then got bumped around on the schedule. It was originally, and it was, what's funny is it ended up in weird spots on the schedule. Like, it was supposed to come out originally in January, and they had it as an October release. So these dates are not prime dates for animated movies. It's not like you're releasing it right before Thanksgiving or Christmas or in the summer on 4th of July. A January release date tends to telegraph that you don't have a lot of confidence in it. Well, they ended up pulling it from the schedule and dropping it and selling the distribution rights for North America to Netflix. It had a limited theatrical release last week, but it is now available today for everybody to see. And I have to say, this is one of the most pleasant surprises I have had with an animated film in a long time. Absolutely loved it. This brought back my love of animated films as much as Wolfwalkers did, although I knew Wolfwalkers was going to be brilliant because of the people involved. Now, this has some great pedigree to it because it has like Phil Lord and Chris Miller, who worked on Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, and they were producers on Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. They worked on the Lego movie. They have a great approach to sort of whimsy for a big high concept people versus robots type movie. And this has irreverence and silliness, and it's told from the point of view of the sort of awkward teenage daughter who wants to be a filmmaker, and she draws pictures and she makes movies with her dog. It's got a real heart to it. And it's one of those movies that deals with the effect of social media, but it doesn't rely on getting the number of likes is what makes you better. Because even something like Wreck-It Ralph 2 fell into that problem, into saying, well, what gives you love is the likes on the internet. And that's not true. This movie is just like, do what you want to do. And if people like it, they'll like it, great. If not, just do what you want to do. And in fact, kind of makes fun of the people who perfect their lives with filters and social media. And it deals with smartphones, because the whole thing is about smartphone technologies that turn into robots and the robots take over the world. But they aren't adding human value to the smartphones. It's still grounded in humanity. And it's got this misfit family who doesn't necessarily fit together and isn't that picture-perfect family, because nobody is. I get so annoyed when you see people who are like, oh, hashtag blessed. And it's so clear that they photoshopped their own family together into their Instagram pic just because they all can't sit still together, but they want it to look like they can. And this movie reaches out to the awkward and the weird and the people who don't have the money and the people who make a road trip across country in a clunker car that still has a manual transmission because they can't afford a brand new car like you see on these car commercials. It really is a charming, fun, wonderful movie with lots of humor and some pretty crazy stuff. It works as an action movie and as a comedy and as a family film, I gotta say. I absolutely love The Mitchells versus the Machines, and I think it's perfect family viewing. So if you got Netflix, watch it. Watch it with your kids, watch it with your grandparents, watch it with your family.
It rocks.
Excellent!
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Things Heard and Seen and the Home Cinema Roundup, featuring a look back at the Beverly Hills Cop franchise. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the next movie in the list, and that is Things Heard and Seen. In the early 1980s, a couple moves from New York City to upstate into a haunted house that connects with the wife and threatens to unearth secrets of the husband.
I'm new in town, and I would love to learn more about the older homes in the area. I don't know anybody up here.
Well, you do now.
Doesn't know what happened here. I think it would be better if we kept it that way.
Everything in the natural world has a counterpart in the spiritual realm.
We're all so inconsequential.
I say death is only the beginning.
This is on Netflix right now. I think it dropped last Thursday. It's got Amanda Seyfried playing the main the housewife in this. You've also got Rhea Seehorn from Better Call Saul plays a friend of the family, and you've got F. Murray Abraham showing up in there as well. So it's got some good actors to it. And much like Separation, it deals with domestic squabbles and domestic strife. The angst and the anger and the bad feelings, it deals with that sort of manifesting itself into a haunting. The difference is, obviously, in Separation, that all kind of comes out of the ether. Whereas in this one, there's this existing house that has this bad juju that's surrounding it and within it. And that the house has a history, and the history still lives there, so to speak. And when the family moves in, and the woman somewhat connects with whatever it is that's in the house, it just augments that. One of the things I liked about it is I did like making it a period piece. It takes place in the early 80s. And one of the reasons that that works is because you get rid of cell phones completely. Cell phones have become a problem for horror movies in a lot of ways because they're such a convenience and so portable and so easy to get out. So you always have to explain why cell phones don't work. You also don't have to worry about certain things in gender politics that have advanced since the early 80s. I mean, back then, it was not uncommon for a woman to have trouble opening an account without her husband's permission. And having a daughter that the woman stays home with, and then the woman, of course, is pressured not to work. So there's a lot of sort of gender roles that just make it play better as a movie itself and how she can get so trapped in there. Now, I think Amanda Seyfried does a great job anchoring the movie. It does fall into the trap of kind of going down similar paths we've seen before. I mean, it is at times a rote haunted house type story. It's very hard to be original with a haunted house story. Now, with that said, there's things the characters do, particularly in the third act, that surprised me. I was not expecting. Not that it's unheard of, but I didn't expect the movie to go certain places, and I respect it for doing that. And I respect the fact that the movie paints some of the characters in corners, because people are stupid sometimes and do stupid things for stupid reasons, and they do get caught sometimes. So I think it's a realistic portrayal of certain things. And overall, I thought it worked. I wouldn't say it was particularly scary, but more of the dramatic thriller that I wanted to see how it would resolve itself. And you know, I thought it was effectively done. So I'm going to have to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Today's spotlight is not just on Beverly Hills Cop, but it's on the whole franchise. But I want to talk about the first one in particular, and let's just launch with that. Eddie Murphy plays a Detroit detective who vacations in Beverly Hills in order to solve the murder of his friend.
Eddie Murphy is a Detroit cop. Hey! On vacation in Beverly Hills.
I just got off the phone with an Inspector Todd in Detroit. He says if you're out here investigating the Tandino murder, you needn't bother coming back.
For a man who claims to be on vacation, you look a lot like you're on a stakeout.
I've asked you some questions about Michael Tandino.
Mrs. Bitch, you are the pride of your department in Detroit.
The reason I centered on Beverly Hills Cop is it's on HBO Max. I think I said this last week when I reviewed Death Becomes Her. I've been mining some of the old movies on some of the streaming services I have, and I want to go back and revisit some of them. And I went to watch Beverly Hills Cop because all three movies are on HBO Max. It was a good weekend watch. And of course, go back and you watch the original Beverly Hills Cop, directed by Martin Brest, who's best known for doing stuff like Midnight Run. And then he did Geely, and that killed his career back in 2003. But back in 1984, when he did Beverly Hills Cop, this was a massive hit. And I gotta say, you play this movie now and you know why it's a hit. I mean, this movie is pushing 40 years old and it is as fresh and fun and has as much energy as it ever had. You know, sometimes you go back and watch movies from, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago and they just don't have the same pizzazz that they did at the time. This one has it all. And it moves fast, it's very lean, and it doesn't sacrifice the plot for the humor. And that was a big thing with Eddie Murphy. You got to have the funny scenes with Eddie Murphy, but every time he does a funny scene, it actually moves the plot along. And that's tough to do because in too many comedies, I mean, obviously the big ones would be like the Austin Powers movies where they will just sit there, okay, stop, we're going to do a nice little funny bit with Mini-Me and Dr. Evil that really doesn't propel the plot. But I mean, those movies are so over the top spoofy anyways. But what makes Beverly Hills Cop work is it's a good detective story. It's got a great bad guy. It's got a very motivated hero. It's got a damsel in distress, but doesn't get into a murky love interest with them. There's no love interest in this movie. It's just a friend from high school, but they kind of play with that trope. It's got some great side characters with the two Beverly Hills cops. It's a fun movie, and it just moves and moves and moves, and it doesn't stop for anything, really. And that's part of what makes it such a watchable film. So I'm going to have to say that the first Beverly Hills Cop totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
Now, with that said, I'm not going to give full-on reports on these other ones. They're not going to get full reviews. But let's talk about the other two. Because I went back and I watched Beverly Hills Cop 2. And it's a little bit closer to Beverly Hills Cop. But there are a couple things about it. It was Tony Scott who directed it. At this point, he was still trying to find what his style was. And I mean, this is a far cry from something like The Hunger, which was not nearly as stylized as a Tony Scott movie. But between this and Top Gun, Beverly Hills Cop 2 and Top Gun, Tony Scott kind of came into his own and had his, you know, almost hyper-real look. I mean, he was Michael Bay before Michael Bay got on the scene. But Tony Scott could still tell a good story. The problem that this movie suffers from, aside from it being forced, so you can tell that the script is forced in a lot of ways, the style is so heavy-handed that it tries to make everything super cool. Like, Brigitte Nielsen is the bad guy in this. She's one of the main, they go, she runs around robbing banks, and they're like posing as they're shooting cameras, and they're like, oh, we have to get out of here. Okay, let's leave. And then they take 20 seconds to shoot up the ceiling of this bank. And then they got to ride away in the most obvious getaway car, which is this like sports car. It gets to a point that it kind of becomes a parody of itself at times. Also, the story and the character and the bad guy were not nearly as good and as baked in as the first Beverly Hills Cop. But anything in Beverly Hills Cop 2 is better than the crap storm we had with Beverly Hills Cop 3. Eddie Murphy's gotten older, so he's in his 30s, and I think he pushed the story so he wasn't acting like the young upstart cop that he did in the first film. Oh, it just doesn't work. It's directed by John Landis, and what's so insane about this is there's scenes in this movie that just the editing and the staging of like extras is so clunky, you would think it was done by an amateur filmmaker. But John Landis, at 1994, he had been making movies for 20 years. He knew how to shoot movies. He knew how to stage big, huge, uproarious events. I mean, this is the guy who did the Blues Brothers, for crying out loud. And he couldn't get people in a crowd at a Disney World type place to act organically. And then on top of the soundtrack is ridiculous. Because, of course, you know, in the original, you had Axel F, the Harold Faltermeyer song, the beep, 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 you know, the synthesizer and everything. Well, they take that song and they put it in the soundtrack and they orchestrate it. So it sounds like a marching band playing Axel F from the 80s when they were doing a show on a Friday night during a football game. It sounds terrible. The story doesn't make much sense. And it seriously feels like everyone was asleep at their job putting this film together. Every single thing that should have been good in this movie is terrible. And Beverly Hills Cop 3 is a waste of time. The only reason to watch it is to see how far it had fallen. So, you know, people talk about, you know, that Eddie Murphy's doing Coming to America. He did the sequel. I don't see him wanting to do another Beverly Hills Cop movie because, well, I mean, the only thing you could say is it can't be worse than Beverly Hills Cop 3. Anyways, that's it on the Beverly Hills Cops movies. There's a couple discs out there right now. You've got Vanquish. We talked about that a couple weeks ago. That's on DVD and Blu-ray. And then you've got The Steelbook of Elvira, Mistress of the Dark. And one of my favorites to talk about, Werewolves on Wheels, which could have had a lot more Werewolves on Wheels in it. And that's it. I need to go. When I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about Wrath of Man and Here Today. Until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.